Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Business Brew. I am your host, Bill Brewster. This episode features Matthew Passy. Matthew is the producer behind many of your favorite shows. Obviously, this is your favorite, but he also produces other big ones. There's a small one he produces called Invest Like the Best. You may have heard of it. Anyway, this is a conversation about him, his business, podcasting generally. Interesting tidbit that came out of the conversation, not necessarily with Matthew, but after the conversation, I was talking to some people that I know that follow Spotify, and it opened my eyes to the huge blind spot that I had in the asset that is known as Megaphone. Megaphone may be a very interesting asset down the road, probably is already. My bad for being blind. Apologies if I've said anything that's led you astray, but by now you should know to do your own due diligence and that this is only for entertainment purposes. So, I don't know. I really hope you enjoy this episode. I think the world of Matthew. I think his team is fantastic at what they do, and I hope you get a peek behind the curtain here. The episode is sponsored by Stratosphere.io. That's Stratosphere.io. Stratosphere is my favorite prosumer financial product. You can get financials, KPIs. Today I was doing something and they didn't have the KPIs on the company that I was looking at. I didn't go through any special back channel. I sent a general request through their web or through the website that I was looking at. Bang, got a response in no time. They said you'll have your KPIs up by the end of the day. And that's the kind of team they are. That's the kind of product it is. I think very highly of Braden and his team. You should try it out. By now, you should know it's free. That's F-R-E-E. And should you want to sign up for any of the paid features, please use the promo code BREW, B-R-E-W, for 15% off. Again, that's stratosphere.io, S-T-R-A-T-O-S-P-H-E-R-E.io. One thing that Matthew and I talk about is the potential for firms to do their own podcasts. Should you want to do your own private podcast, holler at your boy. I am willing to do a contract podcast hosting relationship or arrangement should you want to do that and you want this smooth, silky smooth voice as your host. I'm open to doing such things. Anyway, this is all entertainment purposes. I don't think you need a financial disclaimer, but you should always check everything here on any podcast and confirm it for yourself. And enjoy the show. Thanks again to Matthew for everything he does for this show. And thanks to him for joining. Ladies and gentlemen, thrilled to be joined by Matthew Passy, the man behind most of your favorite finance podcasts. This one hopefully included in your favorites, and definitely he's behind it. So how's it going, Matthew?
I am doing well. Thank you for having me, sir. It's good to be behind it and now in front of it.
That's right. So do you mind telling people how you got behind all the finance podcasts? I remember when I was starting this out, I said, who should help me? And your name came back multiple times. And then thank God I found you because I would have been completely lost without you.
Well, it's there's lots of good folks out there these days, but I'm glad that you and I connected and that I got to be a part of this. So I'll take you back a little bit to the beginning because it'll kind of get us to where we are. But my career started, I worked in radio, worked for a talk station here in New Jersey, worked in the newsroom early mornings. And I was at that station in the early to mid part of the 2000s. And right around the time that I was there, the iPhone first launched and the initial iteration of the podcast store came out. Hmm. Podcasts had existed beforehand, but you had to like download files to your computer and then transfer it over to your iPod if you wanted to listen. It was a little bit of a pain in the butt. But the podcast store came out, and so it was like the first time anyone was like, oh, these are interesting. And I thought the same thing. I was like, oh, maybe we could do something with this. And so I turned to my boss and I said, we should have a podcast. And basically got the, if it doesn't cost me anything and I don't have to do any more work, go ahead, have fun, launch a podcast. So I packaged up our early morning 5 a.m. newscast and put out a podcast for the radio station. That was running. I was taking care of that for about a year or so while I was still there. And then while working at the station, I took a second job working at the Wall Street Journal radio network. their operation was based out of, they say Princeton, New Jersey, really South Brunswick, New Jersey. And they were actually really ahead of the curve in the podcasting world. They've been doing podcasts pretty much since the beginning. And so when I went over there, my job was actually half radio, half podcasting. So I made the move over there full time, and half the day I was spent collecting information, talking to analysts, and helping out the anchors who would go on your favorite radio stations and give like top and bottom of the hour reports on what was happening on Wall Street and what local businesses were doing. The rest of my day was spent launching, editing, producing, creating podcasts for the journal. I hosted our What's News for a lot of years, our tech podcast, our Your Money Matters. I created a few of my own podcasts while I was over there. And truthfully, I thought I was going to be there forever, right? Huh. The other folks who were working at the radio network, folks in their 70s and 80s. And I'm like, yeah, I could see myself retiring here. Good gig. You know, I started there 2008. And when I got there, a short time later, one, we got acquired by News Corp. Two, the financial crisis happened.
Yeah.
And had I been in radio at that time, I probably would have been laid off. But there was a demand for business news, so we were booming.
That's awesome. That's a fortunate coincidence, right?
Yeah. I mean, I would say most of my life has been following opportunity and then getting very lucky in doing so.
It's a theme among successful people.
You know, my dad, whenever I played golf, my dad always said it was better to be lucky than good.
And, that's right.
I'm okay with that advice. But so towards the there for 8 years and mid to late 2014, I'm having conversations. They're thinking about getting even more invested in podcasts. And I'm like, great. I would love to do that. And I was actually going to get interviewed for a job like head of digital audio for our unit. And I was getting ready to get interviewed one day, had the suit and tie on and everything. And I get a call, hey, we're going to have to push this back a few weeks. You know, we still love you. We'll let you know. Just something came up. Okay, no problem. It happens. It turned out what really happened was 3 weeks later, the entire radio department, Wall Street Journal, Market Watch, everybody who was doing radio and podcasting for Dow Jones, we got put on a call at 10 o'clock in the morning and we found out we're shutting you down.
Really?
They completely killed the entire radio network, which at the time made a lot of sense. And I can go into why if you want to later.
Oh, yeah. I'm very curious given what happened in podcasting.
Oh, okay. So yeah, we'll definitely get into that. But they just said, we're just going to lay everybody off. So radio, podcasting, goodbye. We had jobs until the end of the year, December 31st, last day at Dow Jones. So I had actually been in conversation with someone about a different job that I was looking into. And literally the day that that news broke, he called me that afternoon. He was like, okay, we're going to move forward with this. And I thought, all right, cool. Nice to have something lined up. It would have been an interesting opportunity running a small media network for a financial firm, one with a popular name that never materialized. But if we had spoken, you would have listened. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge, who the name was. So post journal, I'm, you know, enjoying a little bit of downtime, collecting some severance, and waiting for this opportunity to materialize. Meanwhile, it's getting pushed back and pushed back. And I start to get calls from people I used to interview regularly at the Journal saying, you know, we always did those podcasts with you guys and it turned out like people would listen and actually connect with us. So you think you could help us launch a podcast? Sure. I'll figure it out. And I got a computer. We'll make it work. So I started to do this for a couple of people I used to know. A bunch of my colleagues went to go work for Bloomberg. They decided they would fill the market where the Journal disappeared and got a good gig working with one of their anchors over there, helping her with a podcast. So I was doing that really just side work, not entrepreneurial, not looking to start my own business, was not my thing. It was just, let me make money while I figure out what I'm going to do next. So that's going along fine. And then it was 2016. I get hit up on LinkedIn by a guy, works in finance, says, I'm thinking about doing a podcast. You know, I did some Googling. There's not a lot of producers at the time, maybe 12 or so if you Google our names. He's like, but you're the only one who ever worked in finance, so you probably understand my content better. Turns out I would not, but still I played a, you know, I had an advantage over everybody else.
You don't do the editorial part very much, which I understand and appreciate. It's like a painter choosing paint color. Like, it's just better left to do somebody else.
No, I mean, when I got hired at the Journal originally, I said to my boss, I was like, I don't really know anything about Wall Street. She's like, it's fine. I'd rather you didn't, because you have to talk down to everybody. She's like, we treat it like sports. You're reporting on the scores. We're reporting on the stocks. Like, so I don't have a finance background. I got a very good education in it working at the Journal. And since then through clients, but right. No MBA. So start to work for this gentleman. He's like, yeah, I'm thinking, man, you know, I'll do like 7 or 8 of these. I really just want this as a way to connect with some other folks in the space who just won't, you know, get on a call for an hour, right? Why would they? I was like, okay, we'll take a shot, whatever. Cool. I'm available. It turned out after about 3 episodes, this guy was like, no, I love it. We're just going to keep going with it. That was Patrick O'Shaughnessy and Invest Like the Best.
Yeah. I remember those early episodes. Those were awesome.
And he had a big advantage in that he had already put out that monthly newsletter with his book recommendations. He, you know, was already a prolific personality on Twitter. You know, the O'Shaughnessy brand meant something. And so his show quickly blew up. And, you know, he always asked at the end of his episode, what's the kindest thing anybody's ever done for you? The kindest thing anybody's ever done for me is when guests, friends, fans, anybody would say to Patrick, man, I love your show. I want a podcast. How do I do that? He was kind enough to say, you talk to Matthew.
Ah, that's dope.
And, so that's really how it got started. And from there it was Patrick and then Ted Seides at Capital Allocators. And I believe Michael and Ben at Animal Spirits came, and then I took over editing for Meb and a few others. And then, you know, pandemic hit, and then the whole thing just went, phew. I thought it was going to be the opposite. When the pandemic first hit, I really thought, oh crap, we're going to be out on the street. Thank God my wife has a job.
Yeah.
We had people we were onboarding who were like, yeah, I don't know what's going to happen. We got to put this to bed, right? Who knows if we're going to have money? Markets are all over the place. And I was like, okay, makes sense. You know, I understand. But then a week or so into it, a bunch of the finance guys were like, we need to put out more content.
Hmm.
And then after about a month or so, people are like, not going back to the office, not doing our conferences. We need to do this. And so I really was worried that this would all disappear at the beginning of the pandemic. And it turned out to, like I said, just to the moon, Alice.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it makes sense. It's how people were looking to connect and how people could connect. Okay, wait, can we go back? Why did the Wall Street Journal kill the radio network?
All because Rush Limbaugh called a Rutgers grad student, not a Rutgers grad student, sorry. It's because Rush Limbaugh called Sandra Fluke a slut on the radio. I don't know if you remember that. Back in like 2010.
That was the cause?
2010, 2011, Rush Limbaugh calls this girl a slut, and it becomes this huge, you know, pivotal point in talk radio, right? Like beginning of cancel culture, right? Everybody calling for heads and whatever. What was happening to us was sponsors didn't want to be associated with Rush.
Okay.
Right. It was like the first time that we really heard sponsors saying like, we can't do it. Our content was running on a lot of the same stations that he was running on, right? Talk radio, AM stations all across the country. And the way that the business of syndicated radio works is we get time on your station and we get to sell ads, right? So instead of having one station, we have access to hundreds of stations. We sell advertising because now we have millions of impressions versus, you know, just a handful. So what was happening was at first they said, listen, our advertiser said we can't advertise on the reports if they are going to be within Rush's show or anything like that. Like, okay, a lot of moves had to be made. We lost some stations, but we made some moves. What was happening was even after doing that, you had promos that would run, or you would have like other ad inventory that we would sell that would get it just got too close to Rush. And you know, you add that to the fact that Google advertising was becoming massive, right? We're talking 2010, 2011, 2012. Facebook advertising was starting to like proliferate, And you just realized that advertisers were realizing they had better places to spend their money. They didn't have to deal with that problem. And so a lot of them just pulled out and pretty quickly. So the radio network was just wasn't going to be sustainable.
Were the programs like shoulder programs for Rush, or because Rush was outside the radio network, right? It's just, he happened to be on the same channel at times, right?
Right. So if you're listening to your favorite station, for a lot of the stations that we were on, we would do maybe top and bottom of the hour.
Yeah.
Or typically we would do something after the market opened, after the market closed. So I don't remember Rush's exact schedule, but I'm pretty sure he was like afternoon drive. And so if you're listening to Rush and then at the top of the hour, he goes, okay, you know, we're going to break. The station would come in, do their news break, do traffic, do weather, throw to us. We would give a quick market report. And so now you would hear market report, an advertisement for Allstate, right, that we sold, and then you'd have back to Rush. And Allstate's like, we're not affiliated with that. But an audience didn't understand that. Now, the interesting thing about all that, because, listen, I get the radio thing, right? Radio is a dinosaur. It's around right now. Who knows for how long? But the end of 2014 was interesting because that's when Serial came out. And that's when podcasts really hit this like pop culture moment, right? SNL did a spoof on Sarah Canning. Like, people really started to talk about podcasting. So for the Journal to cut all of us was really bad timing. Now, they came back 6 months later and were like, we're going to bring back podcasting. And I was, one of my old bosses reached out to me about that, but I had a couple of clients. I was like, can I keep those clients and still work for you guys? And I was told no. And I made a very difficult decision to say, I knew where my ceiling was in the corporate world. And I decided to take a chance and keep going on this entrepreneurial venture and on this path and see what else I could do. The most frustrating thing though was everybody talks about The Daily from The Times being like this great, the beginning of amazing news podcasts. We had been doing a daily news podcast for years before The Daily.
Hmm.
We even had a morning edition and an evening edition. And so when The Daily came out, everyone's like, oh, news podcasts are incredible. I was like, we were doing that forever. I was so upset. It's like, I could have been Michael Barbaro. I was nowhere near as good though.
Well, I mean, it's a function of just time, right? Or timing. Because I guess, yeah, The Daily and Michael Barbaro sort of, at least in my ear, 2016, 2017 is probably when I started listening or whatever. Once podcasting entered my life. It's interesting how just like the timing can create such a different result.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember exactly when that started, but it really was, you know, between the news cycle that was happening around then and the shifting landscape of how we consume content. And truthfully, I mean, their production was stellar, right? Our What's News podcast, I would roll in at 4 a.m, grab a bunch of headlines off the front of the Journal, you know, write 5 to 6 quick stories, and then go out there and put out like a 5 to 6 minute podcast, like one man band. You know, Michael Barbaro and the New York Times have a staff, have a team, right? It's an enterprise. They were supported all the way at the top. So it made sense that was a very successful concept and ours was not.
Yeah, but the Journal could have done that. I mean, that's, you know, but again, it was a little early, right?
Yeah. And truthfully, we were always the redheaded stepchild of the Journal. My boss, you know, we would have people try and go to editorial meetings, try and get into these conversations. And my job, honestly, for most of my time at the Journal was I would get the rundown of what was going to be in the paper the next day. I knew all the stories that were running. And my job was to reach out to the reporters writing those stories for the next day, figure out which stories were going to be interesting to our audience, and I would interview them about their story.
That's pretty cool.
Oh, it was a great gig. I had so many great conversations, learned so many cool things, spoke to so many great people. It was a fantastic opportunity. But there were plenty of times where the reporter would say, I can't, or I don't want to. And there wasn't always anyone from the top that was like, you really need to.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. So it's like the brass never had your back.
Correct. And by the time they did, it was already too late. Now that said, again, many of the reporters over there were fantastic and they loved talking to us. And sometimes the people who couldn't talk, I was like, no, I literally have to go run over to the White House briefing room. You know, I'll talk to you when I come back. But there were always a few who were like, radio? Nah, I don't want to. And yeah, no one would force them.
Well, that's got to be a tough job because you're under so much time pressure all the time, right? And it's like, I have a deadline. I'm not sure. And then I got to figure out tomorrow's article. I don't have time to record a podcast.
Right. And their editors are coming back with, we have a rewrite. We got to check this. We got to do that. And like, they're hesitant to talk about a story and then find out, oh, we didn't use that, or that, you know, that didn't clear fact checking.
Yeah. It's got to be an organizational thing that prioritizes the podcast angle.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Like I said, I really thought I could have done that job forever. I love the people I worked with over there. Love my boss. You know, when we found out we were having a call the next day at 10 o'clock, I had my meeting with my boss that I usually do, and we kind of huddled around. We're like, they're going to let us go, aren't we? And we all kind of felt it was coming.
Huh.
But before that, I really thought, like I said, I would have been there forever. I was a good corporate guy.
Yeah, well, it's a nice life.
Vacations, paid time off, benefits. Yeah, nothing wrong with that.
So when you got the call to go back and you said, no, I think I'm going to stay with the podcast consultant and your company that you were building, how many clients, like, were you cash flow? What did your life look like at the time? Like, how much did you, when you were talking to your wife about this, how much was she trying to figure out how crazy you were versus, you know, what was going on in your head?
So a few things. One, the podcast consultant didn't exist. I was MPassy Productions, right? I had a first client and I figured I had to get paid, and someone's like, oh, you got to start a business. And I ran over to the county thing and filled out the forms. Like, I need a stupid name. And I filled out a stupid name.
sending out invoice 0001.
Exactly. Right. Right. Like those early, early QuickBooks days. And I had my severance, which lasted about 6 months, maybe. I don't remember, 3 to 6 months, made it work. My wife had a good job. But what was happening truthfully was we lived in Mercer County, New Jersey, near Princeton, near my office for the Journal. Cause for part of my time at the Journal, I had to commute to New York. My wife's job was in South Jersey in a town called Mount Laurel. And after I was done with the Journal, we were kind of looking around and being like, we don't really have a lot of friends in this area. Her parents are down in South Jersey. Her job is down in South Jersey. Real estate was a lot cheaper in South Jersey. So we were actually already planning the move down there. So when they came back with this offer, it was partially one, that commute was going to be hellish to go into New York from South Jersey, not just from Central Jersey.
Yeah. You're talking about a drive,
right? We were talking about starting a family and my hours at the Journal. I mean, I worked overnights, late nights, early mornings. I mean, I've seen every hour of the day, as a worker between my time in the Journal and my time at the previous station. And was I cash flow? No, right? Like I think I made enough to help contribute to the rent at the time. But I was going to get a part-time job. I had some connections and I got a job doing social media marketing for a nonprofit. And I was like, there's something here. Like, I can see something taking place. And one of my clients was, her name is Betty Liu. So she was an anchor at Bloomberg at the time. Now she works at the New York Stock Exchange, or she did. I don't know if she's still there. And like, it was just exciting because I would go with her to interviews. I got to meet Greg Norman through her. I got to meet Sally Krawcheck through her.
Oh, neat.
You know, I was having fun doing that stuff. And so I was like, I'll keep trying, you know, like, let's just see what I can do. And maybe this nonprofit will hire me full time, or I'll pivot into something else. So when they really said I couldn't do the other work at that point, I was like, I was tired of having my hands tied.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And I mean, you had enough of an inkling of progress, right? And excitement. So taking a swing, but did you think it would become this? And you got like more demand, I think, at this stage than you can. I mean, now you can fulfill it and stuff, but you've had to staff up. I mean, it's been interesting to watch.
No, I never thought I'd be in the place where I'm sitting in right now. Honestly, was petrified to bring other people on to help me because I felt such a personal responsibility to the early clients, to the shows that I was doing. Like, I was afraid what would happen if I gave, you know, an episode of Capital Allocators to somebody else to edit and it came back horrible. Right. That was, I had a lot of imposter syndrome. I had a lot of, call it crazy. I mean, I was very capable of saying one little mistake and we're going to wind up on the streets.
Yeah.
So it was very, very hard for me to kind of let go and to start to add people. The time I finally, so 2017, my wife and I go from renting an apartment. We're going to buy our first house. So we close on our house in February of 2017. We find out we are pregnant at the end of 2016. We find out it's twins at the beginning of 2017.
Oh my goodness.
They're coming in the summer of 2017. Oh, and by the way, I'm going to quit my part-time job and I'm going to focus on this full time.
It's not a stressful part of life, right?
Just a, yeah. But I mean, I worked in the news organizations, right? I thrive on panic and stress. Like my best day when I was working at the radio station, the first one, was the London bombings, summer 2005 or six, whatever that was, right? That happened early morning here. And so like from the minute I walked in until the minute I left, I was just working and working and, like, you know, making calls, doing this, filing this, moving stuff around. But the time went by like that. I kind of need that pressure. I need to be under the gun sometimes. And so taking that chance and, you know, putting that all on the line like that, especially with the kids coming along, is probably what made the difference.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, I will try not to continue to put you under pressure to get stuff out when it's needless, but I did okay today. I did okay
today. Liar.
I did all right today. All right, so by 2019, could you feel a crescendo building in the podcast landscape, or was it really sort of slow and steady and then 2020 created just this boom?
No, I was feeling the crescendo. 2019 was the fall of 2019. I went out to Arizona for WealthStack, which was a conference that sort of was kind of put on by the guys over at Ritholtz in conjunction with a few others.
Oh, okay.
And my job, they actually brought me out there. They set up a booth so that all these finance guys coming out there, they said, listen, we don't want you to come out here, bring your recorders, grab people, and then disappear and go record podcasts. So they set up a booth. I brought my equipment and everybody could schedule time in the booth. So instead of running away into the rooms to do recordings, they did it right there in the middle of the floor. Everybody could see it, right? Huh. It and everybody had good sound quality. So like that was a good experience. That was actually the first time I'd met a bunch of my clients because everything was remote even before the pandemic. And later that year, I was actually eyeing studio space here in South Jersey. I had visited a bunch of places, was getting ready to sign a 3-year lease. My partner at the time just ghosted me. He had moved to Las Vegas. He was going to do it all remotely. And for some reason, he just was gone. And thank God, too, because if I had signed a 3-year lease at the end of 2019 and then the pandemic in 2020, would have been out on the streets.
Yeah.
Even today, some people say that podcasting has peaked. Some people have said we're over it. I'd say we're still very early innings. But honestly, more importantly, everybody thinks of podcasting as the content, right? You think of this as a podcast. You know, this is a podcasting is a delivery system.
Yeah.
Right? It's these conversations, the kind of content that's being spoken word content has existed for as long as we've been around, right?
Yeah.
40,000, 50,000, whatever you believe is, you know, the extent of human civilization. Spoken content is never going away. And so even if the way it gets delivered isn't an RSS feed and it isn't called a podcast, there's always going to be a need for folks who can capture, clean, and publish content. And now, right, with the advent of social media and everything else, like, now everybody has to be a content creator. So, I mean, that was really what helped to fuel, I think, all of us and why I saw that there was opportunity here.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I think of this closer to radio than I do a podcast. But to your point, the podcast, the delivery mechanism is a RSS feed or podcast, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's all we really are, is we're taking something and we're just sending it to people in a completely different way. You know, there's folks who are doing like fiction podcasts. Right. That's not obviously very new, but when it first came up, people were like, oh, that's amazing. We could do storytelling. It's like, yeah, they did that in the 50s, right? The golden age of radio was, right? We are not that interesting. We just have a more efficient way of getting it out to you.
Yeah. Interesting. How do you think that, like, how has Spotify, you know, the narrative in the investment community, at least, is that Spotify is taking over, or I shouldn't say taking over, but trying to be at the center of podcasting. And you and I were talking about some of the stats. I'm not sure that the stats are as clean as they could be on other places. I mean, how do you think the ecosystem is evolving within podcasting?
I it's funny because when you talk to a bunch of folks in the podcasting space, most of the podcasting world, at least up until recently, was like, yeah, Spotify's also getting into it. But the investment world, and, you know, the folks who I get to work with, and you guys love Spotify.
There, I don't know that I love Spotify.
There is a preference towards Spotify with our clients, it seems.
Yeah.
That said, Apple continues to own the podcasting space. Right. They were the first to make this a feasible thing on their phones. They were the first to put out the store, right? They somehow capture the hearts and minds of everybody. When you think of podcasts, you think of Apple, you think about your ratings and reviews there. Spotify has only really come on recently as a true contender. And I think that was really highlighted when they acquired Joe Rogan. And,
yeah,
and told everyone, like, no, we're serious. We're investing a lot of money into this. I think Spotify is doing some very fascinating things. And to our point earlier about this being a delivery system, I think if Spotify had their way, RSS feeds would go away and it would be a direct connection system, a direct injection, kind of like the way we consume music on all these other platforms. I truly think if you go outside of the US, Spotify is pretty dominant, just because Android phones are more dominant outside the US and Google has been just an absolute shit show when it comes to podcasting. And
yeah, why is it so bad?
I don't know. I don't understand why you can be the most popular platform in the world to deliver video, maybe save for TikTok now, but you couldn't get your stuff together for audio. Like, I didn't understand it. And they've just changed their mind so many times. I think with the latest move that Google is making now, where they are really integrating it not into a Google podcast platform, but the YouTube platform, I think it's YouTube's to lose if they do it right, if they are patient, if they could be smart about it. But so far, it's been so disjointed. They've changed their mind so many times. It's so confusing for the listener, the creators, everything else. It's going to take time if they really want to dominate the space. But if they put half of their technology that they have available out there in the world into podcasting, I think they could absolutely crush it in ways that people aren't even thinking about yet.
The engagement when I look at YouTube is like terrible. And I guess, you know, I'm not very good at thumbnails and all that, but it's just interesting to see the average listener on YouTube does not stay around for very long, where Spotify and Apple, it's a committed listener base. A lot of them get to the end. A lot. But
it's also a different consumption experience. You know, yeah. I don't watch a lot of YouTube on my phone, and I don't think I'm unique in that. If I'm watching video, I typically want to pull out my computer. I want a bigger screen. I'm going to be more comfortable. And podcasting, a lot of podcast consumption is done in conjunction with something else.
Yeah.
So if you're putting out a 90-minute video, right, you're basically asking people to watch a movie to consume your episodes, right? Like, do you really think people are grabbing popcorn, sitting down and watching you chat, right? Like, yeah. I don't expect people to eat popcorn and look at this. This isn't worth that kind of consumption. But with the podcast, I can start in the morning while I'm making breakfast. I can listen to it while I'm exercising, in quotes, because I don't. I could finish it up later when I'm making dinner or doing the dishes or driving. So it's easier to get through this long form content through those other platforms, which is what YouTube and Google's finally figuring out. But that said, YouTube, I think, has been amazing for discovery.
Yeah, that's what I sort of wonder about. I was listening to Ben Thompson and Bill Simmons talk about podcasting. And one of the things that Ben Thompson was commenting on is how hard it can be to grow a podcast. And he was saying that, I believe he was saying that he thinks that podcast networks may solve some of that. I know that Bill Simmons was saying that's where he thinks The Ringer can help people. And I do wonder if YouTube can help the growth of a podcast a little bit more than what's going on now. I'm not sure.
I think there are certainly advantages to having a network and to growing your show, right? Let's take Colossus, for example. Invest Like the Best is now the Colossus Network. When they put out a new show, they have a brand new feed, no subscribers, right? They're starting out just like anybody else. If I were to put out a new show today, I would put out my show and I would have to go out there and tell as many people as possible to listen to it. But at Colossus, I could put out a new show. I could take that show. I can either drop it into one of my existing feeds that has thousands or hundreds of thousands of listeners, or I could even just take a snippet of it, put it in my other show feed and
cross promote it.
Right. And now you have this exposure to a massive audience that most new podcasts do not have.
Yeah.
You also have credibility and history, right? Someone's like, well, if this guy already put out this podcast that I love, I'm surely going to take a chance on this new one.
Yeah.
So there's definitely benefits there. I don't really know if YouTube is going to be the growth engine. I guess, again, growth and discovery are just so different. And my understanding of YouTube and the way they suggest things, I just don't feel like I'm going to be listening to something and all of a sudden that's going to be like, if you like this, check out The Business Brew. Like, I just don't see that happening yet. But I know a lot of podcasters would happily give Google money to do that.
Yeah.
If they were smart. Similar with, you know, Spotify is doing that now too. I haven't done it, but you can advertise on the Spotify network, advertise your podcast. They're like, well, they're already on Spotify. All they have to do is click a button and they could be a follower. So the smart people take advantage of not trying to market to just who they think their target audience is, but market to their target audience that's already content consumers. Right. I think we probably talked about this when you first started. Like, you have to, it's getting better, but like, you still have to convince people to listen to podcasts. And then you have to convince people to listen to your podcast.
Yeah.
So I say ignore that first piece of it and start on the second piece, right? Just convince people to listen to yours. And how do you do that? You talk to people who are already consuming podcasts, which is why people get, you know, go on other podcasts as guests, invite other podcasts on their show as guests, run ads on other shows, run promos, right? Because I don't have to teach somebody listening to this how to subscribe to me on a podcast. I just have to convince them mine is worth their time.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. The amount of shows that I've said no, I mean, it hasn't been like tons, but I'm no longer that interested in growing the show. I used to think that the model was get as big as you can because I used to like the idea of having an advertising model. But I think that some paywalled content and leaning into super fans is probably
the better strategy, at least for me. I don't know about every show.
I did a presentation about a year ago about monetization. And since you're a markets guy and a numbers guy, I'll throw a number at you that will probably confirm what you're saying. A average podcast ad, they are sold in what's known as CPM, cost per mil, cost per thousand downloads, right? So if you get the average CPM in the world of podcasting is around $25, just using even numbers to make it easy. It's not exactly that these days, but right, you get the gist. If you're Blue Apron and you want to buy ads on someone's show, you're going to pay for how many thousand downloads they get for an episode. So if I'm Blue Apron, I am spending 2.5 cents per person, or as the podcaster, you are earning 2.5 cents per person through an advertising model. Now, ostensibly, you're running that ad 4 times a month. Maybe you're running more than one ad. So I'll give you the benefit of the doubt. Your listeners are worth 10 cents to you a month. Fair? Now, folks in our space and you know, people with a specialized niche, they're charging way more than $25 CPM. But again, let's just talk averages, because that's what's going on in the space.
Well, the thing that's crazy is what you're saying, though, is you're assuming that I'm capturing 100% of the economics, right? If Spotify is selling it for me, then I'm down to 12.5 cents. Right?
Because
they take
that.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly.
So that's like
right.
Nothing.
You're down there. Yeah. But so let's just say, you know, you are hustling, you're out there, you're getting the advertiser, 2.5 cents per person.
Yeah.
If you set up a membership structure and you say, hey, here is the Business Brew. If you give me $5 per month, you get a bonus episode each month, or you get an ad-free version, or you get access to other stuff. Now you're receiving $5 per person who listens to your show, as opposed to 10 cents.
Yeah. Maybe you only convert 10% or whatever, right? But I would argue that those super fans that are willing to pay the $5 or whatever it is, as a host, I feel like I can deliver more value than that to them easily. Right. Because then you can start to know your audience and be like, what do these people want? And who is it that really interacts with me? And what are they really looking for?
The reason why I bring this up is twofold. Is one, from a numbers perspective, yes, you're not going to convert as many listeners into subscribers, but I can start making money on a podcast with one listener, as opposed to with a podcast, I need 1,000.
Yeah.
Number two, there are ways to offer premium benefits to your audience that don't cost you anything. One of my early clients was a guy, he does a chess podcast. He loved Invest Like the Best. He wanted to kind of create that show, but for the chess world.
Oh, neat.
He started doing his show. He started to have some early success. He was getting pretty good people on the show. He started a Patreon, and for $2 a month, just two, he would put your name in the credits of the show, cost him nothing. He would send you an email about the show, or put you on like an email list where he would send you certain updates, again, with a free MailChimp account, doesn't cost you anything. He would let those people know who the guests were going to be ahead of time and let them send in questions. So now you're a fan of the show, you send in my question, I turn to the grandmaster so-and-so and say, hey, we have a question from Bill in Florida. Bill wants to know. And now Bill's like, oh, my question was just asked of this person. So costs him nothing to give you that opportunity and turns you into a super fan. And not only that, it quickly became a thing in the chess world that being in his credits, being one of his sponsors, like put you in this kind of exclusive club.
Huh. Right? Like that's kind
of
cool.
You were the in crowd because you were one of the people who had their name on the end of the show. And then he was able to turn it into a little bit more money for people to get priority. You know, he would say, our top sponsors are so-and-so. And then our premium sponsor is so-and-so. And then this person would get a link on the website, right? Like none of that cost him that much money to do. And, within a few months, he had a few hundred people who wanted to give him $2 a month.
Huh.
cost him nothing to get that return. And then once he had all those people, he could show an advertiser, look, I've only got, I don't know his numbers, but like, I've only got 1,000 downloads, but I've got 300 people paying me to hear me. Advertisers are like, I want access to those 300 people. They are committed enough to the chess world to pay you money to listen to this stuff. I would like to get in front of them.
Huh, that's interesting. Does did you do the editing for the Chasing Scratch Guys, the golf podcast that I did?
No, I did not.
They have a cool thing. They have a Patreon and they call it the Velcro, you know, like your glove has a Velcro. Mm-hmm. And it's now gone behind a paywall. They do an extra episode a week and it's not even necessarily golf. It's like whatever they want. And then the community of the Patriots, if you will, although I'm not sure that's the right word, you know, is like become its own thing, right? It's interesting to see the tangential opportunities that arise out of the podcast world.
Yeah, I mean, look at, again, you got Ted Seides doing a premium membership. His started with, he would send you the transcript. Now you get ad-free episodes. And he turned his show into a whole enterprise with the university, with, you know, events, with like, right, all sorts of stuff. Another good example, Peter Attia of The Drive.
Yeah.
He's got a premium membership package too. His is one of the most brilliant things I've ever heard. He does not want to take sponsor money at all, right? He's a doctor. He is very uncomfortable being paid to shill products, understandably.
Yeah.
So what he does is he goes to an advertiser or an advertiser comes to him, whatever. And he says, no, don't give me money. What I want you to do is you see all these people over here, they're paying me for premium exposure, premium membership. They're getting other benefits. Give them a deep discount on your product in exchange. So now he is not personally benefiting, right? He's not getting that money directly from the sponsor. He is able to keep his dignity about the whole thing, but he's creating an incentive for people to join his premium membership, and he's giving them a heck of a benefit from brands and from products that he cares about and that he's willing to say to these folks, like, no, I really think you should get this. I'm not going to make money if you do, but we are making it easier for you to get your hands on something that I believe in.
Yeah, I like that a lot, because then you can say to somebody, yes, you're paying me X amount, but I'm saving, you know, potentially, right, X times three. And then that's win-win-win.
Yeah, and I mean, he gives out other great benefits along with that.
Yeah.
But that was just like, I always thought that was such an interesting approach to the brand sponsorship relationship that I hadn't seen before.
Yeah, it seems much more symbiotic.
And then he could be selective, right?
Yeah.
I don't want to work with
you. Yeah, for sure.
I don't need, like, I'm not losing money by saying no to you.
Yeah. And you can just say, you know, if it's on the website, I believe in it, and, you know, see what you can do with it. That's interesting. How has your discussion and thoughts about the business evolved? I mean, you've obviously seen more of these models. When it was, let's take you back to early 2020. Were you already thinking of, hey, you know, maybe people could do this, or how has kind of this ecosystem evolved since you've been watching it?
My thinking on it hasn't changed much. What I have seen are more tools, more opportunities, more ideas, more people being clever with how to implement them and being successful. What you are also seeing, and this is where I think you get some of the articles about the podcast space is oversaturated or podcasting is dead. What you were seeing is...
That sounds so dumb to me, by the way.
Yeah, we can talk about that for hours. But what you are seeing now is that the nonsense is being taken out of the system.
Yeah.
Right? For a long time in the podcasting space, when I first started doing this for myself, right, when I was really... Listen, it's easy to be a podcaster for the Wall Street Journal. Plenty of resources, right? I put out an episode, we were getting a few thousand downloads because it was associated with the brand. But when I started to do this on my own, I was doing a lot more research and trying to figure out how to help people. You had a lot of very, very smart marketing people, and you see this in every industry, right? Who were selling other folks on how to make money in podcasting, who mostly made money by selling people on how to make money in podcasting.
Yeah. That's right. I'll sell you a course on how to do this. Yeah.
Right, right. So yeah. Podcasting had this reputation of
it's a lot of the new in gold the investment rush. Industry.
Right. There's a lot of it in all that. Right. Real yeah. estate, investment, crypto. Oof.
Yeah.
Right. So there was a big like get rich quick mentality to podcasting. There was a lot. If you podcast, you're on your way to a mansion in Florida.
I'm here to tell you, you're not.
Yeah. No.
But you might get in Florida. I don't know. Just not in a mansion.
Yeah. I certainly not New Jersey. And so I think we've seen a lot of the nonsense, the bullshit, the junk kind of shaken out, and people coming in are doing ideally seeing that you have to do higher quality stuff.
Yeah.
And you also have to recognize what is your ultimate goal, right? Whenever I talk to someone who wants to do a podcast or someone who's doing a podcast, like I'm not seeing enough growth. My first question is, why are you doing this? What is it that you ultimately want to get out of it? If your goal, right? I'm going to be the next Joe Rogan. No, you're not. here's the thing. I don't need the next Joe Rogan. If I want, I have Joe Rogan.
Yeah, that's right.
Right? Don't care. But also,
there's one of those a generation. It used to be Howard Stern. Now it's Joe Rogan.
Right. There's one Joe Rogan. There's one Howard Stern. Right. Like, you are never going to get to that level. And the fact that your ultimate goal is to be somebody else means you're not, you don't have the right motivation.
I like the way you said that.
The people who have had success are the people who are like, they're so passionate about what they do, right? Like, you are not looking for Joe Rogan fame. You love the conversation.
Yeah.
Right? If you did not have to publish this content, you would still talk to these people every week and just enjoy the conversation.
Yeah. If I could, the nice thing that the podcast does is open up the conversations.
Absolutely. Right. It does open those doors for you. But right, like, the motivation for you is not to get rich and to have a billion downloads. So your passion drives the podcast, not the podcast driving your passion, so to speak.
Yeah.
So the folks who are good at this are, they would do it whether or not it had 10 downloads, or they go into it and they say, I was looking for a podcast about X. I couldn't find it. So I created it, right? They fill the void. They find the niche. Or they recognize that 100 million downloads isn't really going to do me any good. But if I can get 100 downloads and I can turn two of those people into clients this year, paid for itself.
Yeah.
So understanding why you want to do this. Oh, and by the way, I have some clients who literally, they don't care if anybody listens. Like, they are more interested in who they talk to, because that has opened up doors, that has created relationships. Those are the people who are actually going to be their next clients, not the listeners.
Yeah.
And then we have clients who are like, we're not, this isn't for a public audience. Like, yeah, it's available publicly, but it's really for our clients, right? When the pandemic hit and stocks were going like this, I could either have to call 100 clients and have the same conversation over and over and over and over again, or I could put out a 20-minute podcast that says, hey, we know what's happening. Rest assured. Here's what we're doing. Here's what we're thinking. Everything's going to be okay. And it's convenient.
Yeah.
I've also seen what I call the lobby model, which is the podcast. I think of it like folks who have a big, beautiful office building in the middle of the city or something like that, right? They've got marble floors and granite countertops and pillars and all that stuff, like this beautiful lobby to get into their office building. They spend a lot of money on that. That lobby cannot go out on the street and bring in new customers. Just can't, right? It's stationary. It's not going anywhere. But when customers come to you and they see that lobby, it creates an impression. Yeah. It says, these folks are well established. They have enough money to put together this beautiful lobby. They keep it clean. They take pride. They take care of themselves. And so for some folks, that podcast really is, it's on our site so that when people come to look at us and they see we have a podcast and they listen, it just elevates our status. It creates better branding for us. And so there's lots and lots of people who could be successful with a podcast without having to get to Joe Rogan numbers or whatever other ridiculousness. And so long-winded answer to your question that you asked before is I haven't seen, my thinking on the podcasting space hasn't changed. The people who are successful have changed. and the people who, the expectations for what will be successful has changed. You cannot just jump in with your buddy and be like, we're hilarious. We're going to be a podcasting comedy sensation. You're probably not. But if you, you know, if you want to create good content and this is the right vehicle to distribute it, cool. Let's talk.
Yeah. And I would say where I have, you know, gotten immense value out of having you on the team is there is a tangible, well, an audible difference between the episodes that I tell you to go ahead and like fully produce and the ones that I say, you know, I don't know, I might want to save some money on this one. So a great example is that Chasing Scratch podcast that I did. I listened to it and I said, this could be a really good podcast if we put the money behind it to do the production, or it can be an okay podcast that I don't know that people, you know, are actually going to stick around with. I think that the finished product that we put out is one that I'm really, really proud of. It's now been listened to over 4,200 times, which I thought was crazy. I never would have thought that a golf podcast on this would do that number.
Is it really 4,200, or did you just want an excuse to slip 420 into the conversation?
No, it's real. I would have said 420. I think that the reason, you know, the retention is not as good on that podcast, but people are, you know, I think a third of people that listen finished it. That's not horrible for a podcast that's completely off topic. And I really believe that a lot of the reason is what you do behind the scenes. And listening to this show, I think it's obvious that it's a professionally done show. And my pitch to anyone that would still be listening to this is if you have a financial firm and you are trying to communicate with clients, I don't know why you wouldn't put the same level of care into the distribution mechanism that you would into any letter that you would write. And I think it makes the listening experience much more enjoyable. So thank you for what you've added to the show. I appreciate it. And I know the listeners do.
Our pleasure. And you know, we've had conversations with clients that I would expect to want to think like that. And what I hear is, you know, we don't really want to spend that kind of money, or two, well, the podcasts I listen to don't sound very edited, or whatever. You know, when we talk to someone about a podcast, we want them to, it's a reflection of your brand.
Yeah.
Right. If you are going to put something out there for your brand, then let it reflect what you're doing. So do you want to be seen as highly polished, very professional, sounding good? Okay, it's worth the investment. Do you want to be seen as consistent and reliable? Then put out an episode every week. And, you know, your favorite podcast that doesn't sound edited, it's probably edited. But that's just how good, that's good editing that you don't hear that it sounds edited.
Yeah, I wrote you about that on a recent one. I was like, this doesn't sound edited at all. And it was done very well.
But right, it's, if you don't want that, that's fine, right? There are plenty of podcasts that are out there. They don't do any editing. They don't do this. If that's the case, your content better be unimaginably important and valuable.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing that we haven't really talked about, but I think everybody who wants to do content these days should think about. Most of us are giving this stuff away. This podcast is free. This video is free. This tweet is free. This whatever I'm doing, all this stuff is free. But everybody is asking the audience to invest their time. And our time is valuable. And our time is in a lot of competition, right? Me deciding to listen to The Business Brew for an hour.
Or two.
Yes, it may be. is not just competing with listening to a different podcast for an hour. It is competing with music. It is competing with movies. It is competing with time with my family. It is competing with the radio. Right? Like, it is, you're not just in competition with other podcasters. And so if you want people to listen to your content, don't say, listen to me or check me out. You have to say to them, here's what I am going to give you in exchange for these 60 minutes. And if you are not going to A, if you're not going to give them anything, and that doesn't have to be education or whatever, it could be companionship, it could be fun, humor, motivation, right? That's not everything is a tangible asset of value. But if you're not going to give them something in return for that time, or you're going to waste their time, or you're going to tell them, we're going to do this, and then you do that, people aren't going to listen. So if you can give value to people, if you can give very, very high quality value to people in 30 minutes without editing, without a microphone, you know, without thinking about how your show sounds or whatever, cool. You have very valuable content. But if you cannot make your content that precious, then you better make it easier for the audience to listen, right? Don't waste their time. Make sure it's not a struggle to listen because you're not using a microphone, or you know, they're mowing your lawn while you're trying to have a conversation, or whatever, right? If you are
sorry
not
about that earlier, I didn't know.
Were they? Because I didn't even hear it.
I was quick with the mute trigger.
Oh,
which I would not know about, but for you, right? I wouldn't have a Rodecaster. I wouldn't have this setup, and that's the stuff that you helped me in the onboarding process, and you helped me think about like how should this be done and how should it sound.
And to your credit, there were many times along the process where I was like, no, Bill, it's okay. Like we can do this the quick and easy way. We don't have to edit it. And you've always said, no, I care about the time that my audience is going to give me.
Yeah. And I think we both view it as art. I think that like one reason that we work well together is we both care a lot about the finished product. And I'll say the same thing to you. I'll be like, Matt, you really don't have to worry about this today. And you're like, no, I'm doing it and it's getting out on time.
Unfortunately, I
tell you that like Wednesday at 8 p.m. and it's a 4 a.m. on Thursday show, but that's a me issue.
Luckily, my kids are asleep by 8 o'clock, so I got time to do it now. In a year from now, when they're a little bit older and they're not going to sleep, it might get harder.
Yeah, well, you just say they can expect more Friday releases, and anyone that's listening, that's on me.
But even that time comparison, I've said it many times before, I don't think actual podcast editing is such an incredibly difficult skill that anybody couldn't learn it, right? Most of the people who I work with are very smart people. Some are not technically savvy, and they are happy to admit that. But most of them, you know, if you show them how to do something, they're going to pick it up. They're going to get to it. And with enough time, like they would edit just as well. And honestly, they might even edit their own stuff a little bit better than we do just because it's theirs, right? We can take care of your content as best we can, but you will always take care of your stuff a little bit better. But again, your time is valuable to you. I can mow my lawn on Saturdays. It's not that hard. But I don't want to.
Yeah.
That hour of time it would take me to mow my lawn is way more valuable to me to be with my kids and my family on the weekend. And for the folks who we work with who are professionals and professionals at a very high level, the 3 to 4 or 5 to 6 hours it would take to produce their content is time that they could be doing a heck of a lot more valuable things with. Right? They could be making so much more money in that time or doing things that will give them so much more revenue than what it costs them to ship stuff to a producer like us and take care of it for them.
Yeah. Or they could be spending time with their kids.
If they find that valuable.
Yeah. You would hope so, right? Or at least the kids should. I have thought in the past, I've been like, boy, this costs a lot. Before I had sponsorship or whatever. Because pretty much the show runs at break even, but I'm totally comfortable with that. And even if I'm losing a little bit or whatever in any given month, I don't mind it because I care a lot about the finished product. I don't think this is the end state of the podcast. I don't think this is the end goal for the monetization. So why not invest up front? And I just think that, especially in an industry like finance, if somebody is considering a podcast, I would do it the right way. There are some people that can do it, you know, sort of just drop the show as it is unedited. And, you know, that's unique.
There are plenty of people who do that. There are plenty of people who are able to sell that as high quality, valuable stuff. Like, it's amazing the range of things that exist within the podcasting space. But also, I'm sure that there are other intangible benefits to your podcast that are more valuable than the direct advertising dollars.
Yeah, 100%. 100%.
And so if that's something that you want to invest in, right? You invest time, and this isn't you, this is the proverbial yous who are listening, right? Those in the financial space. You know, you invest time in your social media, you invest time in your writing, you invest time in, right, all these different things that you do, and you don't always see a direct return on it, but someone's going to say, oh yeah, I read that piece you did. And that's going to make them think a little bit higher of you next time you meet. Or someone's going to come across your writing when they go to, you know, think about who they're going to hire. They're going to say, oh yeah, I remember that thing I read by so-and-so, and maybe I should reach out to them first. So you just have to, it goes back. Why are you doing this? What do you want to get out of this?
Yeah.
And if you understand right. that and you tailor it to that, it should work.
Yeah.
It's not always going to. That's 100% a fact, but it should.
It's a low risk way to take a shot, right? What's the real downside? You got some time to set it up and maybe some cost out of your pocket. And worst case scenario, you have a microphone and a setup for somebody should want to interview you someday. You don't have to say, hey, I don't have a mic and headphones, which is something I get more than I would like to future guests. Note that.
I also encourage, by the way, it is so much better. Anytime I'm asked to be a guest on the show, I was like, oh, no, I have a microphone. They're like, oh, thank God.
It's tough when somebody doesn't have a mic, because I always hope that they sound okay. Lately, it's been, I think if they have an Apple, it's okay, but it's much better with a mic.
The other thing that we encourage a lot of folks is you don't have to come out perfect. Right, you don't have to launch your first podcast sounding like you are working inside the NPR studios with a team of 12 people behind you, you know, sound designing and editing and dropping in the narratives and the spot, blah, blah, blah. You know, you think about some of your favorite institutions, some of them, you know, your favorite things in the world that you consume, the ones that have been around for 5, 10, 20 years, right? The Simpsons. I always go back to this because it's just, it's such a stark thing. If you go back and you watch the first season or the first half a dozen seasons of The Simpsons, the animation is crap. It looks so janky. It looks so terrible. But one, they were delivering good value, right? They were giving very funny, very good content, an enjoyable experience. It was worth it. And two, they gave themselves room to grow. It is a lot better to create excitement with your audience by saying, hey, guess what? We've been doing this for a couple of months. I invested a microphone. Hopefully it sounds better. Or we were doing this every other week, but I'm having so much fun and getting so many guests. Now we're going to do it every week, and saying, you'll get more of me. And your early fans and your audience will be excited with you, right? They'll go along with the journey. They'll be like, yay, this person's sounding better. The show is getting better. I can't wait for more stuff. As opposed to the person who comes out with, I'm doing the show 3 times a week. I'm going to go to the studio, spending $1,000. And then after a couple of months is like, all right, we're going to go down to once a week and we're going to stop using the microphone. And now you've created this disappointment in the audience, right? You've taken away from them. And you're on the wrong side of that curve. So I always say, start small, right? Grab your phone and just record something. Or, you know, don't necessarily edit those first few shows if you're not sure about this. Or don't invest $1,000 in the setup. You always have room to get better. But if you invest too much up front, and it's not going the way you want to, you're going to get frustrated and disappointed, and your content's not going to sound good, and your brand's going to take a hit. So I'm always okay telling someone, slow down, right? You don't have to be perfect out of the gate.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good advice. I have struggled with that a little bit with release cadence, but breaks help for me. But I try to be honest with the audience, right? I need to go on a break right now. And I don't love it, but I don't know. I'd rather do that than, I'd rather be consistent when I'm recording and then go on breaks. And I think I'll probably be more consistent going forward, but who knows?
And I think packaging it as a season helps.
Yeah.
But also you have enough of a following that if you take a break and you say, hey, I'm back, right? We know how to find you. We know how to connect with you. We're looking forward to it. Whereas the people who are just starting off, who are still growing their audience.
Yeah. You don't want to start and then stop.
You know, the reason when everybody asks me how often should I put their content out, I always say weekly. And I'm not saying that because I want to get paid weekly for your content. I say it because most of us are very habitual in our consumption habits.
Yeah.
Right. Today is Wednesday. I'm going to listen to this as I do the dishes and make dinner tonight. If your show is every other week, I still have to make dinner and do the dishes tonight. And I still am going to want to listen to something while I do so. And if you're not there, I'm going to find something else.
Yeah, somebody else will be.
And so it is harder to earn that dedicated relationship if you're just not there for me as often as I want you to be.
Have you seen, I know we've done two separate sort of projects. Have you seen corporations be interested at all in podcasts? I think it should be a core strategy of corporate communication, but I think I'm a little early on that thought.
I was having conversations a few years ago with some folks who were actually treating podcasts as not a public facing product, but internal communication, right? Because people aren't always reading the internal, you know, company emails, or there was one who we did that they were using it as a way to kind of encourage and talk to their employees about different efforts they were making in like DEI and, you know, social responsibility and things like that. So there's probably more of them than you think, but of course, right, if you don't work for that company, you're not going to find out about it.
Yeah.
And there are some, the problem we ran into is that the technology to make a good internal podcast where it can only be accessed like with the right security, with the right protections, the costs go up like this,
huh?
For the hosting and for the delivery and for the distribution, so that it could be consumed like on an iPhone or on a Spotify, like where people actually listen to podcasts. And that was a hindrance to a few different folks who we spoke to. And understandably, it wasn't producing it that was expensive. It was just the distribution that got expensive. And then, yeah, lots of companies have podcasts for other reasons. And the ones who are doing it well put out a podcast that you would listen to even if they weren't associated with it.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. API Group's got an interesting one where it's all about leadership. And I have churned off it, but when I was listening to it, I was thinking, boy, this is kind of interesting. It came out right around the same time that they SPAC'd, which I find kind of interesting, but that's neither here nor there. What was the hosting site that you had recommended to use that's not Anchor? Like, what would I get from going over there? You lose the video, right? Don't you have to be on Anchor now to have the video on Spotify?
So yes, if you want video on Spotify, you have to be on Anchor. You were the first person who we did the video on Anchor. It was kind of an experiment. Anchor reached out to me about one of our other shows and said, hey, we really want to get this person on our platform using video. I'm like, they don't do video. But I do have someone who's chomping at the bit. You were asking about it.
Yeah, I thought it was a good idea.
Yeah. What we have found since then, and we've done this with The Drive, actually, we kept his original hosting. So if you go to listen to the show on Apple, Google, Amazon, right, all the audio platforms, it's the same original feed as before. They pulled the audio show from Spotify and they just published the video version over there so it can be video on Spotify. That can work for some folks. I'm not sure it works for everybody. When it comes to hosting in general, my three recommendations are, if you want to do like real big corporate networky stuff, you know, if you're the Times, if you're the Journal, ESPN, right? These large institutions, Megaphone, which is also owned by Spotify. They're really like the corporate network hosting solution. They were just early to the game and they have a lot of features and opportunities for bigger companies who need to monetize across their entire network.
Okay.
We still like Libsyn, which is what you were on originally, what most of our clients did originally. They've been around forever. They are very reliable. Their pricing structure is such that your pricing is dependent on how much you upload each month, but then you don't have to worry about how big your show gets.
Yeah.
And that was advantageous.
Which is nice because you can control one and not the other.
Right, right. And so that was advantageous for a lot of our shows who wanted fixed costs. Now, they are adding more and more features, and you then have to pay more for certain features, and certain things are just okay. But, you know, if somebody says, should I host on Libsyn? My answer is, yeah. Like, they're a solid, good company. Like, nothing wrong with working with them. The other one that I have been recommending a lot is one called Captivate. And they are very, very feature rich, and they are very independent, creator supportive. Their business model is slightly different, where you pay a fixed rate. You can upload as much as you want. I can create 20 shows for one low price. But then once I cross a certain threshold of downloads each month, then I start to see my pricing increase. But so I think originally it was like 13,000 downloads. I think that number is almost doubled since then.
That's a pretty big show.
Right.
But per month.
Right. So once you've been doing it for 6 months, like, your monthly numbers might creep up there very easily. But
yeah,
I can launch 13,000, not episodes, different shows. And as long as they all get one download, I'm okay. But honestly, even their pricing, you know, if you're doing that many shows, if you're doing that well, if you're, you know, able to monetize, like, their pricing is still very reasonable. The other thing is they're really good at new features. So they have very cool network controls. So we were talking earlier about dropping what they call a feed drop. So if I launch a new show, I can drop an episode of that into one of my old feeds with like a push of a button.
Oh, interesting.
They have these like templates for my show notes. So, you know, it's literally like short code blocks. So I don't have to recreate every time.
Show notes are kind of a pain in the ass.
Yeah. And they have this awesome dynamic insertion engine. So if I wanted to advertise on my podcast, I can click two buttons and now I have an ad running on all my shows. And let's say I want to run an ad in April for, I don't know, Mother's Day is coming up. Go and get your flowers. But then in May, I want to turn that ad off. I can turn it off on all of my shows, the entire archive. And so if you download episode one or episode 1,000 in May, now it's Father's Day is coming up. Get your old man a set of golf clubs, right? Like, and not even just for advertising, but there's just a lot of very creative ways that people could be using that. They also have dynamic show notes. So if you put your ad in, it'll actually ad copy, right? It'll, like, you know, you could put copy to go along with it. So, right. Oh, here, use our promo code. Okay. We're done with that. Here's our new promo code. And, you know, so they're very thoughtful. They're very easy to work with. So they tend to be my top choice that I like to recommend to folks, but most of them are pretty good. There's only a handful that I would tell you absolutely do not go with them.
Yeah. And you can tell people that in private. We don't have to say that on the pod.
I'm not putting anybody but SoundCloud on blast.
So what is somebody's listening to this, they're thinking about starting a podcast. What is the onboarding? I know what the onboarding looks like, but what does it look like when they email you, and what should maybe they expect? I would hope that at least one listener is listening to this and is inspired to reach out, because I think they should be.
I will tell you, the onboarding is basically a series of calls and emails that we help you identify why you're doing this, what you hope to accomplish, help you make good decisions about the title, description, find you some good music, help you with the artwork, whether we're creating it or just supporting you as you're finding the right artwork, getting you the right equipment, showing you how to use it, giving you tips and tricks and training you to be comfortable on the microphone. And then making sure, right, we pick the right hosting. We talk about monetization, websites, all that good stuff. We're going to take you from I Want a Podcast to, great, you have a podcast. Now people can go listen to it wherever they like to listen to podcasts. Honestly, more so than I think the launches, though, these days, I bet you there's more folks who would be interested in something else that we do that we don't advertise enough, which is what we call our audits. We were starting to get a lot of clients who were coming over from other podcast producers, and we just found that there's a lot of bad advice out there. And even if it's not nefariously bad, there's also a lot of people who, like, their boss is like, hey, marketing, go put me out a podcast. And the person's like, right? And like, they did their best. They put out a podcast, but they didn't know what they didn't know. So we're finding a lot of shows who are out there. They're struggling. They're not seeing any growth. They're frustrated. They don't know what they're doing. And so we can look at a show, listen to it, analyze your marketing, look at your social, look at your website, and be like, hey, here's why your show isn't working. There's like, you know, I can tell you why your baby is ugly, right? I can be.
Your baby is breathtaking.
It is not, probably. It is, right? Like, I can be very critical constructively of people's show. And honestly, most of the time it's obvious stuff, but sometimes people just need to hear from somebody else about why their show sucks. Or not even that their show sucks, but why everything else they're doing to support their show is a waste of time, or, you know, ice skating uphill, right? Whatever euphemism you want to use for that. So I imagine more of your audience is probably interested in what's wrong with their show versus starting a new show. And so that's a better thing that we offer, these audits. So we take a look, we take a listen. We could do it, you know, just as a 1-hour call right off the cuff. Like, let's just get into it and go. We do one where we take a little bit of time to analyze. Then we have a couple of calls. And then we do this premium one where I'll spend like a week really analyzing, putting together this report, and then going through for 3 hours, however you want to use it, what we found, what we saw, answer your questions, you know, guide you through whatever we can to put your show back on the right track. Honestly, that's probably the thing I've enjoyed doing more these days than anything else, is because it's weird. You get on a call with someone, you're like, oh, I'm about to tell you, you suck to your face. Okay. But then, you know, by the end of the call, they usually end with people being like, they're so grateful that somebody was honest with them, that somebody gave them hope for this thing to work and not just told them, give it up.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not, I mean, when you say you suck, I mean, there are, I'm sure, some hosts that don't have hope, but I think to your point that you made, a lot of the times people are running, you know, ice skating uphill is a great way to say it. And there's so much time and effort spent on stuff that is low return that I think, you know, being able to talk to you and bounce ideas off you has helped me sort of stay in the lane that I think I should be. Whether, you know, it's the right lane for me is probably the right way to say it.
Yeah. I mean, that's the good news, is that clients get that for free, right? It's just part of the deal. You are working with us. So if you have questions or like, what's going on? You know, I say I'll jump on a call with you as quickly as I can and walk you through it. So that's a benefit if you want to shift and work with us and do your production. But yeah, if you have a good editor, you love them, fine. Your kid is editing your show, no problem. But if you want someone who has probably made every single mistake and is finding new ones even as we speak, you know,
you're their guy.
Yeah, you know, I feel like the old guy at the bar near the door, like, I've seen a thing or two. You know, like.
Well, you had, and you had. You were the next Michael Barbaro, and it was stolen from you. And I am upset, but I am also grateful, because if you were, you would not be my producer.
That's true, but maybe I'd be in your ear every morning telling you about the news and why the world is falling apart.
That's true, but I prefer you in this role, if that's okay.
Of course.
All right,
I'm happy to be here.
I appreciate you stopping by, and thanks for doing the pod. And I hope people learned, and I hope, you know, this is beneficial for you as well. It's been great getting to know you.
It's been a pleasure, and just keep up the good work, sir.